This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The world is a pretty big place, and that's just not me saying that. I've heard the same thing from scientists. It's the size of the planet that can sometimes make climate change a difficult concept for a lot of people to wrap their heads around. A new book is trying to knock that concept down to size. It's called The Atlas of a Changing Climate, and it's beautifully illustrated with contemporary and historic maps and images from around the world. It is the work of Brian Buma. Dr. Buma is an assistant professor of quantitative biology at the University of Colorado and an affiliate professor at the University of Alaska. His explorations and wanderings around the globe have been featured in National Geographic. We spoke about the new book and why he chose to use these unique graphics to tell the story of a warming planet.
Yeah, the motivation for this book really came from a desire to explain why the world works the way it does and why climate change works the way it does without being preachy, without preaching to the choir, in just a simple way where people can draw their own conclusions. Because when I talk to a lot of folks that don't quite get, you know, climate change, don't understand why it's a big deal or why it's happening, it's usually for a totally understandable reason of we're just not well equipped to think about the world at the scale at which it needs to be thought about, you know, at the scale at which it works. You know, if we're standing on, you know, flat ground, we can see about 3 miles in any direction, which equates to an area of about 27 square miles or something, 30 square miles. That is grossly underrepresentative of the whole world. And I get that, right? We evolved not to understand things that happen at scales of 10,000 miles or at scales of 5,000 miles. And so understanding why climate change is a big deal when everyday weather is so variable is completely understandable. And I just don't see a lot of resources available for folks that are in that position, you know, folks that don't have a science degree or folks that don't want to go to, you know, school for environmental science. Like, I understand that. And I love reading science books, but, you know, I'm a scientist. That's where the mapping came in. That's where the charts come in. So the book is about 50% text and about 50% graphics. It's mostly imagery. Many pages are nothing but images. It uses historical maps, beautiful, beautiful historical maps from the past centuries, modern maps, and then some really cool emerging technology that uses lasers, for example, to map the Earth's surface, things like that. And the whole point is attacking that scale problem, you know, and giving people a way to think about the world at the scale it needs to be thought about, you know, not thinking about just the fact that it was cold today means climate change isn't real. No, it was cold today, sure. And I understand why people come to that conclusion, or at least think it's not a big deal because of that. But to talk about why it's cold, you know, why Senator Inhofe, you know, in 2015 brought a snowball into Congress and said, you know, climate change isn't real because it's cold outside. Like, that's, you know, motivation aside, that's really just a misunderstanding of the scale at which the world works. And I wanted to address that directly in a way that doesn't preach, in a way that doesn't make people feel bad for not necessarily understanding this sort of thing.
You spoke about the historical graphics in there, and some of them are just fascinating. It's almost a history of how humans understood the world.
Yeah, it is. And that's emerged from my goal of sort of talking about scale, because we really didn't understand how the world works until we started making these big, ambitious maps of, you know, the natural environment at the scale at which it needs to be understood. You know, one of the first examples is Alexander von Humboldt, very famous in the scientific fields in the 1800s. He mapped the mountain and drew life on this mountain all at the same time. And so rather than thinking about one particular spot, he was taking in the scope of the whole mountain and saying, this is why things are where they are across this very big scale. And then later, folks mapped the whole world and mapped where different climates were just a few decades after that. It was revolutionary because all of a sudden people were conceptualizing how climate works at the scale of climate as opposed to at the scale of weather. And as we've gotten better and better at charting the natural world, we've got a better handle on how the process works. And I think it's just beautiful. I mean, we can now describe these processes, we can model these processes, we can map them, and it creates just the most beautiful patterns of the world. You know, the patterns of hurricanes around the world. There's an incredible imagery. One of my favorite images in the book is a map of where hurricanes occur around the world. So not just in the North Atlantic, but everywhere, Northern and Southern Hemisphere. You can see why there's a whole bunch more hurricanes in the Northern Hemisphere rather than the Southern Hemisphere. And you can see the parts in which the Northern Hemisphere tends to get hurricanes or typhoons, you know, in the Pacific. And you see these patterns and processes emerge over thousands of miles, and it's just gorgeous. It's just absolutely beautiful.
Well, speaking of beautiful images, you speak early in the book about the importance of the famous blue marble photograph that Apollo 17 took. Why is that such an important image?
Yeah, and there's actually a funny story about that I didn't know until reading the book. The original image actually has the Earth flipped over, and it's not even in the middle of the frame. So the famous blue marble picture is actually ever so slightly modified. It's just rotated to put the familiar sort of Northern Hemisphere on top.
Yeah, it had Antarctica on top, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was just flipped over. It was revolutionary because it all of a sudden snapped people's perceptions from just the local or maybe cartoon maps. You know, we didn't have satellites at that point, or satellite photography, you know, wasn't commonly available at that point. Snapped people's attention from the local and the regional, you know, oh, it was a cold year this year. We've had a few cold years in a row or this side of the other thing, to, boy, the world isn't that big. You know, when you look at it, the blue marble picture, you see Africa, you see storm systems, which, you know, range 500 miles. You see that, yeah, nothing is remote on this circular planet. You know, nothing is disconnected. It's all local in a sense. You know, if you get far enough away, it's all local. And that image is one of the most reproduced images of all time because it kind of punches you in the gut. And as a scientist who does a lot of written work like myself, it really like emphasizes the power of images is real. And it really gets us to the heart of the issue, which is there's one planet, there's no part that's separated from any other part. And that image really encapsulates it.
You break the book up and the planet and environment up into five sections: the atmosphere, the water, the land, the cities, and life. And in it, you speak of how atmosphere is the one thing that affects us every single day, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's funny that, you know, it's got to be the most cliched conversation opener of all time. You know, crazy weather we're having today. Yep. But it's true. It's something we just deal with all the time without ever really thinking about it. You know, I mean, it impacts every aspect of our life, from, you know, what we're wearing today to whether we plan a party outside or this, that, or the other thing. I mean, you know, you're talking from Florida, I'm in Colorado. This can play in New York and other places. Everyone has a different conception of their local weather. And so it's something we're really intimately familiar with. But stepping up to the scale of climate is a whole other step. It's an important fundamental aspect of how the world works, is just to understand a little bit about how the atmosphere works. I hope it's not too far of a jump because, again, yeah, we're all intimately familiar with at least the atmosphere immediately around us.
In the book, you talk about the work of Charles Keeling, and he said he was the first to observe that the Earth breathes. Talk about his work a bit, would you?
Sure. Yeah, Keeling, most listeners are actually probably familiar with his work because they've seen the Keeling curve at one point or another, because it's often on nightly news. Charles Keeling was a man obsessed with really precise measurements. In particular, he was focused on atmospheric composition, so he was measuring carbon dioxide in the air. That doesn't sound like a big deal now because we measure things like that all the time. You can measure atmospheric composition in high school chemistry if you want. But when he started, that was actually really, really difficult. And he was perfectly equipped because, by all accounts, very meticulous instrumentalist, very meticulous measurements. And he started in California and he started measuring carbon dioxide concentrations. And he noticed that it was very difficult to get clean measurements of the natural world because of industrial pollution. So he actually traveled around the world measuring carbon dioxide and eventually settled in Hawaii because he could, from the top of the volcanoes on the Big Island of Hawaii, get a fairly pristine measurement, you know, middle of the ocean and all. And what he noticed was every spring there was an awful lot of carbon dioxide in the air. And every fall there was less carbon dioxide in the air. And then every spring it would go back up again. And what he was able to do is tie that to the earth, to the seasons of the earth. In the summer months, the northern hemisphere, which is mostly terrestrial, is pulling a lot of carbon dioxide out of the air. You know, the plants are growing. And in the winter, they're not. You know, in the winter, obviously, most plants in the northern hemisphere aren't doing a lot of photosynthesis, but they're still breathing out. They're still respiring. So carbon dioxide is still coming off those plants in the winter. And so what he saw was essentially a yearly inhalation in the summer as life on Earth pulls in carbon dioxide, and a yearly exhalation in the winter and then into late spring as respiration continued, but the carbon dioxide wasn't coming in. And so that's the same curve we use today. And so for many decades now, we've been charting that inhale and exhale every year. And every year it's gone up a little bit, inexorably up year after year. When the earth breathes in, the carbon dioxide doesn't go down quite as far as it did the previous summer. And when it breathes out, it goes up a little more than the previous spring. And so when he started, we were in the low 300s in terms of parts per million, depending on the time of year. Now we're in the low 400s. So it's gone up dramatically.
Still to come, our conversation with Brian Buma continues with an exploration of the planet's water. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Brian Buma, an associate professor of quantitative biology at the University of Colorado and an affiliate professor at the University of Alaska. We're talking about his new book called The Atlas of a Changing Climate. He begins the section of the book devoted to water with this statement, "Water is the new oil." I asked him to explain.
Yeah, I think water is... it's one of those natural resources that may not be as fully appreciated yet as it needs to be. It's obviously necessary for our daily lives. It's very difficult to move. You know, it's a heavy liquid. You know, it's very difficult to move around. And it's changing. Now, a lot of people, especially in the U.S., have this conception that climate change means precipitation is going down. And that's not actually true. We are seeing increases in precipitation around the world. But where we're seeing it is moving. And the thing with water is we need it, kind of like oil, to power stuff. And in particular, we need water to power agriculture. And if it moves away from agriculturally sensitive regions, either in terms of less rain or precipitation at times we don't want it or at intensities we don't want it, that's going to cause big problems. So California is seeing less rain. The Midwest is seeing more precipitation, a little bit more, but it's coming in pulses, which is not great for farming. And so we're unable to essentially power our agriculture. I was faculty in Alaska for a long time, and I was in Juneau, Alaska, where it rains over 6 feet a year. I mean, it's wet. It rains all the time up there. And it was very difficult for me to communicate to students, or it was very challenging for students to understand that they need to care about water, even in places of a country where we have too much, because so much of our food comes from areas that are marginal for water. And so it is one of those things that powers humanity, you know, agricultural production, and we're causing it to move around. So that's why I think water is one of the, if not the most pressing natural resource facing a lot of us today.
Well, from what you write, it looks like the peninsula of Florida is going to be in big trouble because of water in the next 100 years or so.
Yes. Speaking of too much water.
Yes.
Florida's in trouble. Florida's facing a lot of challenges. The high point of Miami-Dade County is only about 6 feet above sea level. That may be entirely underwater by 2100 and will likely be underwater by 2150. The ocean is warming and rising dramatically. And like a lot of things in this book, the point of the text is simply to put it in simple, straightforward terms, because none of this is really controversial. You know, as we warm up the atmosphere, ice on land is melting, and that's raising sea level. And as we increase the temperature of the ocean, it's expanding, and that's raising sea level. So we're raising sea level, you know, depending on the decade you look at, and it's accelerating, you know, about an inch a decade or so. And as that increases, we're going to see higher and higher tides and higher storm flows. And the end result is low-lying areas are threatened. There's nothing really controversial about that. The trick is a lot of our cities, we love to live along water, right? Like a lot of our people and a lot of our infrastructure is there. So this is a very challenging problem that we are not going to solve if we don't just accept what is happening, the basic physics of what is happening. You know, one of the most crazy things for me looking into this was how fast the ocean's warming. A lot of these phenomena, again, this is the scale problem, are really hard for us to understand, myself included, because the numbers are so big. You know, the ocean is warming at a rate currently equivalent to like 3 to 5 atomic bombs a second. We've been talking for 10 minutes. That's a lot of seconds. That's a lot of energy going into the ocean, heat going into the ocean. That's going to result in higher sea levels. And unfortunately for Florida, we're locked into a decent amount of rising seas already. So this is a real issue.
Now, as someone who lives in Florida and is familiar with the politics of the area, no one cares. I'm just saying, no one cares.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny. That was actually another motivation for this book, if I can sort of take it off Florida for a second, just to explain that this is a challenge I think scientists face. And a lot of us who've been in ecology and climate change science for a long time, we write a lot of peer-reviewed papers. We write a lot of stuff for other scientists. But talking to people who actually, you know, make these decisions or vote on the ground is not always a priority. And I really think it should be. And so this book is written for those folks. It's not to scare them into caring, simply to explain, this is how the system works. Here's some imagery so we can talk about the scale of the problem. This is how we understand it currently. This is how our understanding has changed over time. Make your own conclusions. And I hope that's what folks like that take from it.
Well, you talk about cities in the book too, the urban environment, and that's really the one we humans have the most control over, isn't it?
Yeah, the cities angle is a fascinating one for me. I'm actually not really a city person. I grew up in small towns. I've only really lived in what people would consider small towns. But urban areas are fascinating to me, and they're fascinating because they're the one environment people have created. It's like a self-created habitat. You know, it's like a glorified termite mound. We create these things to do stuff, right? Like we've not necessarily to be comfortable. You know, we create them for a variety of priorities, economic, commercial, bringing people together for defense. There's a variety of reasons we create them, but they're undoubtedly human habitats. And the fact that, you know, more than 50% of people are moving or in urban areas now around the world suggests we need to treat them as such. And all the sciences are like, there is whole disciplines of soils, soil scientists, for example, who study like urban soils. Like it's this own thing, and we do have a lot of control over them. And one of the cool things about them is you can sort of see the world in miniature when you go into a city, because there's species from around the world that people have brought in. And the climate varies a lot depending on where you're standing, because there's more or less cement. And so you get a lot of variability in climate, you get a lot of variability in species, and you can see how things interact with people. And again, the point of that, another point of that chapter was emphasizing we are not separate from the rest of the world. Like there's not much distinction between natural and artificial. You can see it all happening. And so that chapter was really fun to write because of that. Yeah.
And you spend an awful lot of time there with trees. And you make mention especially about Washington, D.C. and its trees. And most people don't think of trees when they think of D.C.
You know, they don't, which would just appall our founding fathers, I think. It's actually in the late 1800s, so I suppose those guys were all gone, but DC was actually very focused on its trees. There was a big emphasis on competing with the beautiful cities of Europe. Folks wanted to have a beautiful arboreal city with shade trees on the major walks and a diversity of species from around the world. And a large part of it was, let's be competitive with the big cities, let's with Paris and Berlin and things like that. So there's a rich data source there, and there's a rich history of stories in DC. The Library of Congress commissioned many maps, which are gorgeous, some of which are in the text, of shade trees in DC in like the 1870s and the 1880s, down to like listing the species and what blocks they were on. You know, you can do this. There's actually a project I have going with some folks at National Geographic where we've digitized all those things. And there are actually places in DC, quite a few places where you can go along streets that have exactly the same trees they did 150 years ago. And in fact, some of those trees are probably the same trees as 150 years ago. And they wanted to plant those trees there, you know, that good old competitive spirit we love so much, but also because shade trees are an incredibly important part of the urban environment. And some people call them urban forests, or bringing some wild lands into the cities. And you can look at them that way. But I also look at them essentially like the way the city sweats, you know, like trees are really important for regulating temperature in cities. Just the presence of a tree near your house can lower the temperature that that you experience, because they transpire up. They release water into the atmosphere just like, you know, as part of their metabolism, but it's very similar to how we sweat, and you lose heat that way. So trees are an important like component of a functioning urban environment, much less just being a natural sort of forest thing. They really are like a biological machine that we can use as an air conditioner. And so they're important. They need to be considered and appreciated.
Well, we're running out of time, which is a shame, because we haven't even touched land and life yet, which life could be its own like volume of books right there.
That's true.
With all the information that we've accumulated about climate science and all the people trying to get it out there, are you hopeful that things will be able to be turned around?
You know, I am hopeful. I don't think you'd last very long in these fields if you didn't have at least a little bit of optimism in you. I'm hopeful for several reasons. Mainly, it comes down to the younger generation in particular is mobilized in a lot of ways. You can see a lot of the demonstrations going on at COP26. COP26 itself is an indication that countries are taking this seriously, and there has been a lot of action pledged. But you know, beyond that, there's a lot of demonstrations pushing for more that's coming from the younger generation. So as their presence becomes increasingly more powerful, we'll probably get a lot, I hope, we'll get a lot more action. There's also emerging technologies. You know, the largest carbon capture facility in the world just recently went online in Iceland. It's hard to predict where that will go, but certainly we're clever, if not anything, for better or worse, humanity is quite clever. We're not going to be able to avoid change. Like we've through our inaction over the past 40 years, we're locked into some pretty dramatic things, such as flooding in Florida, for example, as sea level continues to rise over the next century. There's a lot of things we can't undo, which is unfortunate. And it is unfortunate that we're not going to feel the pain of that for another several decades, because it's a scale problem. It's a time scale we're not used to thinking about. But I am optimistic that we will find a way to weather the storm eventually.
Again, the name of Brian Buma's new book is The Atlas of a Changing Climate. It's published by Timber Press. A warming planet and warming oceans will have a huge effect on life on Earth, including life under the sea. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Climate change will have many effects for sea life. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Richard Aronson, professor and head of the Ocean Engineering and Marine Sciences Department at the Florida Institute of Technology, dives in.
If you live at mid-latitudes, say in Boston or New York, your summers are hot and your winters are cold. Not so in the tropics and Antarctica, where ocean temperatures are more constant over the seasons. Fish, snails, sea stars, corals, and other cold-blooded marine species at the extremes of latitude are adapted to the narrow temperature ranges. That makes them especially vulnerable to global warming. Temperate zone species, on the other hand, are adapted to wide fluctuations. So cold-blooded species and their communities are responding more rapidly to climate change near the equator and the poles. I use paleontology and ecology to reconstruct how those communities responded to climate change in deep time and project their futures in a warming world. Ocean cooling in Antarctica over tens of millions of years froze out predatory fish and crabs and gave us the unique communities we see today. Rapid warming is letting predators back in and reversing the long-term trends forced by cooling. Recently, my colleagues and I have been looking at whether climate change in Florida and the Caribbean is driving reef corals out of the tropics to the slightly cooler waters of subtropical latitudes. The jet stream is dipping southward more frequently these days, bringing weather that's too cold for the corals, and that will get worse. So corals along Florida's east coast will be hammered by freezes from the north on the anvil of rising temperatures south in the tropics. The main species of reef-building corals in Florida and the Caribbean are already declining drastically. So it's possible that only a few species of corals will be around in any decent numbers. What will reefs look like? What ecosystem services like food and shoreline protection will they continue to provide? That's what we're working to understand.
That was Richard Aronson of the Florida Institute of Technology. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.